Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.
Hi, gang. Now, if you'll all be quiet, we'll start the show.
TMOS Classic Friday Flashback.
What a thrill it is for me on this show. I am so delighted to have this gentleman on the air. 25 Emmy Awards. Just think about that. Think about Nightline for... Well, I believe that show ran for 1,000 years. Nightline ran on ABC, and he's with us right now. I'm talking about Ted Koppel. Ted, welcome to the Mike O'Mara Show.
I was just saying, you realize you are nothing without Rob Spiewak.
That's right. I say that every day, Ted. Ted, I would have had you on this show under any circumstances, but when I heard about the work you're doing to raise awareness of COPD, which for those of you that might not know is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, this became personal for me because I lost my father 1993 at the age of 77. Back then, we didn't know anything about it. I mean, there was nothing about it. There wasn't even a term for it. And I am delighted that you are shedding light on it because there's so much we need to know. And that's why you're here. And Ted Koppel, what an honor. Thanks so much for coming on the Mike O'Mara Show.
Well, you're nice to do that, and I couldn't be more delighted to help shed a little bit of light, because as you undoubtedly know, there are 15 million people in this country, 15 million, who have been identified with COPD, and the estimate is that there are another 16 million who have it but don't know it. Think about that. 31 million people. So, your experience with your dad is almost certainly the experience that almost everybody in this country has in terms of knowing someone in their immediate circle who's had COPD. And it kills 150,000 Americans a year. I realize for people who tune in and want to get a couple of laughs on your program, that's not exactly the way to do it. But it's a terribly important subject, and I'm glad you're focusing a little bit of attention on it.
Well, I wanted to, and I've been an admirer of yours. You wouldn't remember this, but on the campus of American University, I think you were outside the NPR studios in Washington, and you took time to speak to me and another guy that got into the business, Jeff Newman, and we were always just really, really delighted that you had taken the time to talk to a few journalism students, and it was a great memory for me. My question, when did you first become aware that your wife, Grace Ann, had a problem? If you can briefly take us through that and how that whole thing transpired.
Yeah, actually, we were over in Europe on a vacation on 9/11 in 2001. And obviously, all of the attention at that time was on the terrible events of 9/11. My focus, I'm afraid, was on the fact that my wife couldn't walk more than 50 yards without having to sit down and catch her breath. And so I said, as soon as we get back to the United States, and we really have to get you examined and find out what's wrong. And she had just, before we went on vacation, she had gone to our family doctor, who knew that she had trouble breathing, who gave her a complete physical, and in effect said to her, lose 10 pounds, you'll feel like a new woman. We went out to the Mayo Clinic, and it was at the Mayo Clinic that she was diagnosed as having severe COPD. And when she asked that obvious question that people tend to ask, so, all right, what does that mean for me? How much time do I have? They told her, you need to start making end-of-life preparations in 3 to 5 years.
Oh,
again,
my God.
That was 17 years ago.
Wow.
So the good news is, even though it is an incurable disease, and that's tragically the first thing that most doctors tell you, you've got an incurable disease. What they don't tell you is you've also got a treatable disease. And because Grace Ann is a good, Catholic schoolgirl who did everything the nuns told her to do, she has been doing that, and here she is 17 years after she was told she had 3 to 5 years left to live, and she's still going strong.
Why does something that affects so many people, I think I read, is it the number three killer in this country?
Yes, it is the number three killer. Cancer and heart disease being one and two.
Why does something affecting so many people get so little attention, where we need a Ted Koppel to get out there on CBS Sunday morning and tell us about it? Why so little attention for this?
Well, first of all, I think there is an association of guilt there. You know, you were probably a smoker. You brought it on yourself.
My dad was a smoker. Yeah, absolutely.
2 points. Mm-hmm. 2 points, though. 25% of the people who have COPD never smoked a cigarette in their lives.
That's
stunning. And point number two, you know, this guilt association business is something we need to drop with regard to COPD. We don't go around telling heart patients, you know, if you hadn't hit Mickey D's 3 times a week, if you weren't drinking, you know, a quart of Pepsi every day, if you didn't eat ice cream 3 times a week, maybe you wouldn't have gotten that heart disease that you have right now. You know, we can't focus only on what people have done that has brought this on themselves. Fact of the matter is, most of us who spent our lives sunbathing and as a result of it got, you know, 1 degree or another of skin cancer, mm-hmm. don't want to be told it's your own damn fault.
The best part of your story is that your wife has done so well. When I was researching this interview, I found myself checking dates and bylines to see how is she doing right now? What is because she's been amazingly successful.
As a matter of fact, we, you know, she just yesterday had her biannual checkup and she's doing fine. Back in 2001. When she was first diagnosed with COPD, she had 26% of predicted lung capacity. 26%. She is now back up around 50% and has managed to keep it there for several years now. That's a hell of a lot better. She can, you know, except for flying on a plane, she doesn't need oxygen anymore. There was a period for almost 3 years when she was on oxygen full time, 24 hours a day.
That is stunning. And of course, when my dad was diagnosed, they didn't even know what it was. They said, maybe it's emphysema, maybe it's, I remember the big question marks with doctors. What does someone do if they think they or a loved one have this condition, have COPD? What's the first thing you would recommend they do?
I would recommend they go see a pulmonologist. Okay. But even if they, you know, even if they only go to see their family doctor, insist on being tested for COPD. And you just made a passing reference, Rob, to the I'm Mike. I'm sorry.
That's
you
okay.
Just made a passing. You see, I've got Rob on the brain because he's been pestering me now for about 3 months.
I've got Rob on the brain because I look at a TV monitor and I have his giant head in my face every day, so I see that.
There you go. You know, the first thing to do is to be tested to see if you have COPD, and part of the problem is, people tend to be diagnosed with it late in life. They tend to be diagnosed with it when they're already in their late 50s or 60s or 70s. If they could be diagnosed earlier, if they could be diagnosed, for example, in their 40s, it's possible with the help of the proper inhalers, and I want to emphasize this more than anything else, with pulmonary rehabilitation, which means you exercise under the supervision of professionals. And basically, the exercise is fairly benign. It means getting on a treadmill, and initially, you may be working out at a very, very slow and easy level. But you build it up, and you maintain that. Grace Ann exercises every single day of her life. She goes down on that treadmill that we have down in the basement, and she works out on that for usually half an hour, 45 minutes every single day. And that, together with taking her inhalations in exactly the correct fashion, has kept her alive and kept her well.
How does this work with this cause? And we've only got you for a short period of time. I want to ask you about lots of other stuff that one would ask Ted Koppel about. How does your work with this cause compare with all the other incredible things you've done in your career?
Well, it clearly means a lot more to a great many more vulnerable people. I must say there may have been millions of people who watch Nightline, but I doubt that any one of those programs meant as much to people My wife and I have the Family Foundation. We have opened up 11 pulmonary rehabilitation centers, most of them in West Virginia. We're just opening one in Kentucky. We have one in North Carolina, one in Louisiana, and one in Southern Maryland. And the people who go to those pulmonary rehab centers report such enormously positive results. I can't stress that enough, and there simply aren't enough of these pulmonary rehab centers around the country. And not only are there not enough, but the reimbursement rate that some of these hospitals get for giving someone pulmonary rehab is roughly half what they get for cardiac rehabilitation, which is essentially the same thing. There shouldn't be any cost difference whatsoever.
It's just I'm thinking as we're doing this interview, I really hope in our listening audience that some people are impacted by this immediately. I think that's going to happen, and I think that's a thrill, and you're doing great stuff, and really continue to do it. On to the state, Ted, of journalism in this country. The news media
from one disaster to another.
The news media, you know this, have been under fire for a while with the fake news accusations. How do you feel that the journalists on all the platforms are doing now? Well, I think we know how you feel about Sean Hannity, but how do you feel that we are doing in the world of journalism right now? Because they have been under fire. What do you think the state of journalism is currently?
Well, you know, when you say all the platforms, Mike, you're in effect underscoring what one of the biggest problems is. There are so many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of platforms, because anybody with access to the internet, anybody with access to a laptop computer is capable of starting his or her own news operation. It can be the most amateurish, or maybe not even amateurish, literally, you know, when we talk about fake news, there are millions of examples of real fake news out there. Right. Is the New York Times the biggest example? Hell no. NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, Fox? No, they are not the biggest examples of fake news. You know, what we have is, and it sounds like a good thing, but it's not. What we have is a total democratization of news. And what that means is that anybody, with or without any professional training whatsoever, with or without any professional sense of ethics whatsoever, can get the word out there. And part of that has resulted in a great deal of confusion about what's real and what's not.
These are interesting times that we're living in right now. Have you ever seen anything like this, like what we are experiencing now? Are there any parallels in you know, with your long career?
Certainly parallels, you know, from a political sense. I mean, the McCarthy era was similar in the sense that a great deal of lies were propagated by some unscrupulous people out there, led by Senator Joe McCarthy, and a lot of lives were ruined, a lot of careers were destroyed. But the fact of the matter is, back then, the capacity to spread fake news was, you know, the tiniest fraction of what it is today.
And you had access. I think that was probably someone doing a show like yours, Nightline, when there weren't 10,000 people out there trying to grab the same people. You had tremendous access. I would imagine that when Nightline called, it was a pretty powerful deal for the subjects that you had on that show.
Well, it was, because you have to remember, back in 1980 when Nightline began, CNN had just gone on the air. MSNBC didn't exist. Satellite television was in its infancy. The internet did not exist in the sense that it was accessible to the public at large. So all the many, many outlets that exist today were still in the process of being born. So back then it was ABC, CBS, and NBC. And Nightline at 11:30 at night was the only television program on the air that covered the news at 11:30 at night. So, you know, if you somehow missed the news on ABC, NBC, or CBS at 6:30 or 7, there was no place else to go late in the evening to figure out what was going on. So you're right. When Nightline called, you know, the most important people in the country said, absolutely, what time do you need me to be there?
I don't. I know people that do what you do don't like to single out individuals, but I know when I'm sitting there watching the news or I'm watching someone on the tube and I say, now that's it. Now that's the right question. That's what I'm sure you're Ted Koppel. You're a human being. You have moments like that. Are there any journalists working today that stand out in your mind that are doing particularly good work?
I'm not going to do it in terms of journalists, but it's funny because this morning I was listening, as I do most mornings, to NPR. And they were doing a couple of terrific pieces that were, you know, 4, 5, 6 minutes long. And I turned to my wife and said, that's what needs to be done on television.
Yeah, that's true.
Being done.
Yeah.
So, yes, let's give a tip of the hat to NPR and PBS. They're still doing a terrific job. And yes, there are people on the networks who are still doing a good job, but everybody is in such a tremendous battle to make money these days. It may sound naive to say that because there actually was a time, back in the 60s and even into the 70s, when the notion of a news division making money was just sort of strange. We didn't think about that. And the networks didn't think about that. There was sort of a deal out there. You go ahead, you can make your hundreds of millions of dollars with I Love Lucy and 77 Sunset Strip and Dragnet or whatever other program you want to put out there. But we also expect that you have a full-fledged news division doing what a news division should do, giving the American public the information it needs to have for a functioning democracy.
There's a viral video that circulated around with Ted Koppel and Sean Hannity about a year ago when you were on that program. I think you were on. Were you on his, or was he on? No, of course you were in his world.
I was doing a piece for the CBS
You did a piece
Sunday
on it. That's right.
Show. We were doing it on his set, but it was my
on his set. That's
I was right. interviewing him.
When you go into an interview like that, you kind of know what's going to happen. Do you steel yourself for battle when you go into that world? Because what came out of it was it was a viral video where you're saying it bad for America and that type of moment. What was it like dealing with him as an individual? Because you don't get a lot of profiles on a guy like a Sean Hannity, and I'm curious what that experience was like for you.
Actually, I've known Sean for many years, and we've always had a pleasant relationship. And ironically, it wasn't, particularly skillful interviewing on my part, and I didn't go in there with an agenda to get him to say something like that.
Right.
He raised the question. He put it to me and said, "You think I'm bad for America, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." and then it was incumbent on me to explain why.
We have to give some credit to the American people that they're somewhat intelligent and that they know the difference between an opinion show and a news show.
Yeah.
You're cynical. Look at that. Yeah.
I am cynical because,
You think we're bad for America? You think I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
You do?
In the long haul, I think you and all these opinion
That's
shows...
That's sad, Ted.
No, you know why?
That's sad.
Because you're very good at what you do and because you have attracted a significantly more influential.
Well,
let me finish the sentence. Let me finish the sentence before you do that.
With all due respect,
you have attracted people who are determined that ideology is more important than facts.
Oh, I want you back on television every night. If Ted Koppel was teaching my journalism class, he probably would tell me not to ask this next question, but I have to do it because I've got you. And when I get somebody, I have to ask the typical question. Was
hey,
there
Mike,
a
hey, Mike, yeah. Mike, hold it.
Yes.
Don't
yes.
answer that question.
I'm asking it anyway, and you would tell me to do that anyway. Was there a single story, and I'm not just including Nightline. I'm talking about when you go all the way back to... the early days when you were working on ABC, was there a single story you covered that stands out in your career? Not necessarily at how it impacted America, but just personally how it affected you.
As you can imagine, I'm asked that question quite a bit, and
that's why I asked.
The better part of 3 years in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. clearly that had an enormous impact on me. I've covered, depending on what classifies as a war, I've covered, 8 to 10 of them over the years. When Nightline spent a week in South Africa, really as apartheid was just beginning to crumble, and we got the South African government to agree to put some of its senior representatives on the air with black leaders in South Africa. That was a huge deal. I was with Mikhail Gorbachev, sitting across from him in the Kremlin, in his office, as he was on the phone with George H.W. Bush saying goodbye. On the last day of the Soviet Union, he and I watched the Soviet flag come down over the Kremlin for the last time, and the Russian flag being rehoisted after 70 years. Those were big moments. I was with Nelson Mandela, a couple of days after he came out of prison. I was the first person to interview him in Winnie Mandela's garden in Soweto. That's what makes journalism such an extraordinary profession, because people who, under normal circumstances, wouldn't get within a mile of these events or these people are given leeway to be a tiny part of history.
Now, measured, fair, a calming voice. That those are my memories of you on the air, Ted. And by the way, you still riding a motorcycle? Are you still a biker?
No, I gave that up about 2 years ago when I started getting nervous. The minute you get nervous and the minute you feel your reflexes are not what they once were, it's time to put the bike away.
Well, you are so kind to have taken the time with us. I want to make sure that we get the information out on COPD. It's the copdfoundation.org. You can find out more about that. And, Ted, fill in the blanks if I'm missing anything or anything that people need to know about COPD before we let you go.
No. You're doing fine. The important thing is you got to understand right now it's the number three killer among major chronic diseases. Number three killer. Where does it rank in terms of funding by NIH, that is by the National Institutes of Health? 155th. We got to turn that around.
I hope we do, and with your work, that's going to happen. Ted Koppel, I don't say it lightly. It is truly an honor having you on the program, and I wish you and your lovely wife, Grace Ann, nothing but success in the future, and thank you so, so much for taking the time to come on the Mike O'Mara Show.
You're very kind, and I really do have to say your buddy Rob Spiewak is the biggest pain in the ass I've ever known.
He's right here, Ted.
Yes,
he's right here.
I know he bothered you
because his boss came to him, Ted, and said, get me Ted Koppel with the whole COPD thing. I said, I need to speak to this man, and I know he pestered you, and that's why. Well, that's what we have to do with our little engine to get somebody up.
He's terrific. I definitely wouldn't have been here without him.
He's
a treasure. Hold on to him.
Hey, for the next 2 weeks, you're absolutely right.
Couldn't have come at a better time, Ted. Thank you.
Ted Koppel, God bless you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's
legend. Awesome.
Wow.
I get to get up in the morning, and Rob did. Oscar.
Yeah.
How about that? Our boy getting the...
That's a legend.
Did you see that one coming?
Not at all.
Because everything you had said to me... I have to pull the curtain back.
Please do. Every time
we talk about Rob, it's like, Rob, you have to show more initiative. You have to do this or that. Right there. Do you realize what he did for your stock in this world right now?
I had two favorite moments in the interview. When he said you were doing fine, because that had to make you feel 10 feet tall, and when he called me a pain in the ass. I mean, these are two moments that we're going to put in our bucket list.
To be your ringtone.
Yeah.
I've told this story on the air that a bunch of us were hanging out of 61 WAMU, and we were hanging out, and there was Ted Koppel in a limousine going back to ABC when he was doing Nightline.
Yeah.
And we sat there, and he chatted with us just like he was a regular dude. And, how about how... He lists the accomplishments at the end of that interview where he's just telling you what he was a part of.
Oh, I know.
It's just a real exciting moment for me as a guy that was, has been into broadcast journalism my whole life to get a guy like that. But Rob had to, I don't know how many emails you had to send.
I think we started in November swapping emails, and he's been teaching at Stanford, and he refused to do it on West Coast time. His quote was, "You guys are great, but not 6 a.m. great." So, and you know, one thing we did not get to, I know, like when I came in, I had to explain to Andrea who Ted Koppel was and how important he was.
Because he's been out of the limelight that long, where there are many people in our audience that won't remember Ted Koppel, which is just
When I was doing the research, it blew my mind. His big break, he came to the national consciousness on radio covering the assassination of JFK.
With Charles Osgood.
Yes, and that he was supposed to do a short report, and it turned out he had to fill 90 minutes, and like a pro, he filled 90 minutes.
Ooh,
and so, I mean, just unbelievable. It's such a neat
guy. Do you remember him, Oscar? Do you remember Ted Koppel?
Oh, yeah, I grew up with him every night. It was Tom Brokaw, and then Ted Koppel would be on, depending on how my dad felt in the evening, what network he was going to go with.
Yeah, because this is the way Nightline rolls,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you had a national story, if they got a great get,
yes,
it would be Nightline. Otherwise, a lot of people would go to the late night talk shows. But Nightline was either a huge story of the day, mm-hmm. which they would cover. Or it was an amazing get, an amazing interview where everybody would. Nightline's ratings, I don't know the history of the ratings, but I think they would spike when you would get that big person that would come on.
And it had its roots in a great cause. Nightline started as a nightly report on the hostages in Iran in 1980. And it turned out, it almost started as a special. And it turned out that it had such a good fit at ABC Late Night, it turned into a series.
TMOS Classic.
Now, as you know, the San Diego Zoo is one of the finest zoos in the world, and we've had this young lady on the show very often the past, I guess, 7 or 8 years. She's been appearing with us.
About 9 years.
Hmm?
About 9 years.
Right, yeah. Several plus several will be about 9.
You said 7 or 8.
No, I didn't say 7 or 8. I said several.
Then you said 7 or 8, and I said it's 9.
Yes. 9, good, thank you.
Yeah. Some of the animals you had as babies are now 10 years old.
That would be about right.
Remember the animals that did something funny on your tie?
Yes.
Those little lions, the little baby lions, were 1 year old.
That's right.
They are now treacherous and ferocious 10-year-old animals.
Okay. Yep. Anyway, Joan Embry is here tonight.
And she's now 32.
That's right. Joan is an animal handler and a trainer. And you really think you're fooling everybody, don't you?
No.
And she
I'm
also...
I'm just here to do my best to help you.
I know that. And she does her 3 horse shows a day. Did you know that? At the animal park.
Boy.
What?
What an exciting idea.
Would you like an army cot or something? Maybe just kind of catch up on a little nappy poo? Just might snap you out of it. Okay.
I love Joan. I'm the only one who went down to see Joan. Doc has never seen her. You've never seen her. I went to the wild animal farm.
It's all right. It's all right. It's okay.
But you're upsetting me. You're upsetting
me. No, I don't upset you.
I went down, Joan, and I
know you did. That's all right.
Don't say...
What?
I know her. I went down and...
Oh, I know you did. I know you went down there.
And I held a baby gorilla.
I couldn't go with you that week. You held a baby gorilla. Good, all right. And let's get her out here quickly. Would you welcome Joan Embry.
TMOS Classic.
All right, are you ready to give us an audio vault, even though you've been all ramped up today?
I am. I'll try not to unfriend anybody for the next 9 minutes.
Okay, go for it.
I've also, whenever I run into a truly great piece of music, Mike, I like to share it. And what happens when America, when the world really is at crisis, disc jockeys get together and make parody records.
Okay, let me get my dynamite ready.
Are you ready?
Sometimes
this one is called North Korea. I think you're going to like it. It's very clever.
Oh, I got it.
Ooh, just look at Kim Jong-un.
We'll never know how great that was.
Kind of worth coming into work today, wasn't it?
Are we going to be able to get those Fat Baby t-shirts out before this thing's over?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, we are definitely going to. We need to just go over a couple of pieces of artwork, and then we can have them by next week.
Chop, chop. Let's get that done, because I think we're going to. We have my wife, in her infinite wisdom, referred to Kim Jong-un as the Fat Baby.
That's good.
And so we're simply going to have a picture of Fat on top, picture of him, baby.
Perfect.
Fat Baby.
Love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, because I knew Tony was coming in this week, I've been saving this. BuzzFeed.com put together a list of the worst Beatles covers ever. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to share some of them with you. The first one, Mike, I think you've probably never heard this before. Mm-hmm. Sean Connery doing the song In My Life.
There are places I'll remember all my life. Though some have changed.
That's terrible.
Isn't that horrible?
That is really bad.
Some have gone.
Sad, really.
What is he doing?
I mean, John Lennon was shot. He's still alive, and somehow that's sad.
Yeah.
I
like but you know what? It's that's better than In My Life being used for Sleepy's mattresses.
I agree. I agree. Do you remember...
You Beatles fans.
Do you remember in the old days? I think she did the Griffin show a lot. Mrs. Miller?
Oh,
she was like
a
novelty act.
Yeah. I remember her. Yeah.
A novelty act, and she did a couple albums. Here's her take on a kid's favorite, Mike.
I like it.
Yeah, it's good. It is good.
The bubbling sound? That's actually her.
That is. Now, Buzz, help me. Who is Xaviera Hollander? That's the happy hooker?
The happy hooker, yes. Yeah, author.
Well, she'll be especially happy after she knows we played her version of Michelle.
Michelle, my bed. These are words that go.
You know, are you turned on?
There are whores and then there are whores.
Yeah.
But she falls into that category of just. She's kind of big and gross.
Well, now, yeah.
No, you know what I mean? Yeah, she's just like overdone, and just gross.
She was like an ex-madam, I think, when she recorded this. So yeah. She was old when she was young.
Performing alone, if you know what I mean, while doing this song?
Yeah. Well, you know her. She was big.
I don't like
I love this one. This is Bill Cosby.
Ah. I don't really want to stop the show, but I thought you might like to know.
You see?
That's going to play the song.
Bob McCartney has the most money in the UK in Raggots and Rolls and Reason has it.
Wow.
See, that as a novelty record, I'm laughing at that because really it's Cosby squeaky, probably when he was hot.
Yes.
And I like that. And now Bill Cosby, I mean, I've been blessed to interview Bill Cosby more than once. And what's great about Cos now is that he will just go off on a tangent.
You never know what he'll say.
And it's still Bill Cosby.
Yeah. He oftentimes forgets to promote why he called.
Yes,
yeah. Right. Yeah, but he will go on and
you
talk.
Know what? He shows up in a sweatsuit, you know, when he's talking to you now. Right. And it's cool. He doesn't care.
And, right. And we're from the same era. So, yeah. I mean, Bill Cosby was the man. And
he was.
I don't care if he's 150 years old. I mean, the fact that he comes on to my show and talks, I loved it. And I let him ramble. I don't care. He's Bill Cosby. He gets that kind of respect.
Course.
You ever heard of a singer called Wing?
No.
Asian.
She's Scandinavian.
No, that's someone else. This is Wing.
Who's
she's
the other
Asian.
One-name person that wears feathers all the time?
Oh, the one who wore
Bjork.
Bjork. Yeah, you won't confuse her with Wing. Here's Wing doing an early Beatles favorite, Mike.
Wing.
She's Asian, Okay, and I close. Oh, well, just a taste of this, because everyone loves this one. Shatner.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly.
Really?
That's become kind of a classic.
It has.
I love this guy.
And it was the very beginning of Shatner poking fun at himself. Shatner getting the joke about
resurgence
Shatner
of his career,
and really he became legendary. He's iconic because he's an example. You know how many guys we used to have TV people come into the studio that hated the fact that they were associated with these series that they
old
had been
series.
On.
Gilligan syndrome.
You know, Werner Klemperer was on Colonel Klink. He could never ever accept the fact that he was known as Colonel Klink. Shatner embraced being Captain
Loved
Kirk
it.
And he went on to bigger and better things, and I think he's just a model for how to handle TV celebrity.
He's great.
Two more real quick.
Tony could learn a few things from
Tony. Hey. Yes. We'll talk about it over lunch at Wegmans. Tiny Tim. Mike.
That's even high for Tiny Tim.
I know.
Can I ask you a favor?
Yeah.
Is there a way to start that again?
Sure, you bet. His mess up at the beginning.
I love that they chose to keep that in.
Yeah, it's charming,
where
really.
Where he reacts to his own mistake. Yeah,
once again, Tiny Tim.
Listen. Good call.
That's a good call.
Yes, I love that.
Now, the last one.
Do you remember who I met Tiny Tim with at the same, performing on the same venue?
I don't.
I met them at the Desert Lounge in Pasadena, Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
And Tiny Tim was performing on the same bill with Tubby Boots.
Oh, Tubby Boots!
Oh, yes.
Tiny and Tubby.
Oh, yes.
Tubby Boots.
Tiny and Tubby Tour.
Fantastic.
So
that
disgusting.
Is quite a bill.
Right? I would say if there was any weakness to that performance is that it was under-orchestrated. Just him and the ukulele. Our final clip does not have that problem.
Okay.
One of the greatest entertainers of the 20th century, really, if you consider all 100 years, Mike, this is Bing Crosby.
Hey, Jude.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
Don't make it bad.
Thank you, everybody.
That is terrible.
Those are the worst Beatles covers ever.
Sure are, Rob.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Gary Rydstrom?
Nope.
No, he has 7 Academy Awards. He won 2 of them for working on Jurassic Park. Okay. And he did an interview revealing what he did to create the noises of dinosaurs. Uh-huh. You can't just go out and record dinosaurs.
What comes to mind, what jumps into my mind, is being in the theater and that incredible shot of the glass of water.
Oh, I love that.
Vibrating with the T-Rex. It was incredible.
And Spielberg later explained that he got that idea because he had his car stereo turned up, and whenever the bass notes would hit on the subwoofer, he would see that vibration in the water. He said, I got to use that for the dinosaurs.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, except brilliant. He said subwoofer. The Brachiosaurus bellowing, Mike, is a donkey braying slowed down. That's a slowed down donkey for the Brachiosaurus.
I love this stuff. I could listen to this all day.
I love this stuff too.
Now, when the T-Rex growls, it's a Jack Russell Terrier playing with a toy slowed down. Isn't that great?
Wow.
I love this.
Brilliant.
Little dog.
Yeah.
I love that it's that simple.
You know what's brilliant about it, though, really? He's using, it's organic. He's using other animals.
Right.
He's
not so it doesn't sound like something otherworldly.
And I think, as opposed to something that's computer generated, that legitimately has the fear fact because it is an animal creating a scary sound.
When the T-Rex roared, it was a baby elephant trumpeting slowed down. Here's the T-Rex roaring. And I love that he went with a baby elephant because I think it would be too low if it was a grown-up elephant. Right.
This the last is great. One, I love this, Rob.
The last one, the Velociraptors. Forgive me. When they talk to each other, remember when they had them in the kitchen and the kids were hiding and the Velociraptors were.
Just remember Sam Neill. And that means you're still alive when they eat you. All right, go ahead.
So when they're communicating, he recorded at SeaWorld 2 turtles having sex. And incorporated a male dolphin in heat. So this is the sound of the velociraptors talking.
That's the turtle breaking through the shell.
That's right.
That is so phenomenally wonderful.
Yeah. Worst porn ever.
Have a little reverb and you're good to go.
Yeah, and we close. I don't know if you know this. Do you know that Rihanna and Chris Brown have broken up?
What?
Again? Yeah,
what?
It's true. Yeah,
good.
Conan covered it last night.
Rihanna broke up with Chris Brown after she caught him cheating with a waitress. Rihanna said she knew something was up when Brown came home with another woman's lipstick on his knuckles.
Oh. That, Mike, that is your magic audio vault.
Want more? Make sure you check out the Mike O'Mara Bonus Show.
You can listen to the Mike O'Mara Show at tmospodcast.com.
Mike O'Mara Radio Entertainment.